Community Radio.
It's about real people.
Not sound bites.
Not more talking heads.
Not on this show.
Interchange is a community access media forum fostering unfiltered open dialogue on the people, issues, and events impacting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Conversations that challenge the ways we perceive the world around us.
Real people.
Real issues.
This is your forum.
This is Interchange.
Hello and welcome to Interchange. My name is Lewis Malone, and I am here with a group of guests, a group of scholars from Indiana University, and we're going to be talking about Native American culture and the Native history of Native Americans here in the United States. Tonight, we do have Dr. Brian Gilley, who is, and correct me if I'm wrong, the director of the First Nations Educational and Cultural Center and an associate professor of anthropology at Indiana University.
Yes.
All right, excellent. We have Dr. Jason Jackson, associate professor of folklore and American studies at Indiana University.
Yes.
And we have Dr. Christina Snyder, assistant professor of history and American studies at Indiana University.
Hi.
Hello. So we have three people here, and we're going to be talking about, just so everybody's aware, we were talking about Native Americans today, in part because this is 2 days before Thanksgiving, one of the quintessential American holidays. And we often talk about the pilgrims and their buckles on their shoes and the hats that they have, but we do want to talk about the other people that were present there and the people that were really here on this continent at the beginning, when the people showed up. This is not an empty continent. So the first thing I'd like to talk about, perhaps Dr. Gilley, if you could talk about some of the Native people that were present here before European colonists arrived.
Well, first I want to say it's also National American Indian Heritage Month, so which Thanksgiving happens to ironically fall in that month also. We don't really know how many different groups of people were in North America and South America at contact, but we do know that it was very diverse. Mm-hmm. That, you know, you hear numbers like 500 tribes or 500 nations, but no one really knows because the idea of the nation didn't quite exist yet. So you had people who counted who they were by where they lived, the things they lived around, who their relatives were, things like that. So that was really, that's really the most important thing to understand about natives before contact, is just the sheer diversity.
Okay. So there were
society.
There were a lot of people, and there were a lot of differences amongst those people. Dr. Jackson.
I would just add that one of the ways that we know that that diversity was great beyond the traditions that Native peoples have and the evidence that archaeologists can point to is linguistic diversity, such that today, even in the 21st century, there are hundreds and hundreds of Native languages spoken in the Americas, and we know that there have been many languages which have gone out of use, and so that the evidence that language offers points to just the stunning diversity of Native peoples in the Americas. And if we think about it from the Arctic to the bottom of South America, that's a huge territory, widely diverse landscapes, and the peoples that lived there were as diverse as those places.
Absolutely. And so we have these groups of people. They're here. Are they generally, obviously regionally, they might be communicating with each other, but there's no, you know, transcontinental kind of communication amongst the people? Or is
there? We do know that there are transcontinental trade networks.
Oh.
So, I mean, people are trading kind of precious goods and metals and paints from all across the continent. So, you get obsidian from the Southwest, you get galena from the Great Lakes, you get copper from Lake Superior, and these kind of things you see all across Native North America. So through archaeology and oral tradition, we can see how Native people are connected through trade, and they're probably also communication flowing along those networks, mm-hmm. and even people intermarrying and things like that. So it's a diverse continent, and it's also a connected continent in a lot of ways.
So that doesn't sound, you know, you have an economy, you mm-hmm. have various different peoples with different languages. This doesn't sound very different from the cultures that we might have grown up in, you know, world history class listening to, but we don't really hear about the natives
and
as
people
often.
Are fighting and disagreeing too. One happy continent or
right.
a couple of continents, you know. It's mm-hmm. people are upset at each other too.
Dr. Jackson was going to
come. I'll just add, Christina was speaking of the various kinds of goods that would travel over vast distances, and one of the kinds of things we might add to that list would be foods, right? So that mm-hmm. we think about corn on lots of people's minds this time of year, and obviously important to lots of Indiana folk. you know, corn isn't indigenous to Indiana. It came to Indiana from faraway places through the ingenuity and efforts of Native peoples and those kinds of networks that Christina was evoking a second ago. And it fits into the complicated story that Brian was evoking a moment ago as well.
So that whole saying, there's more than corn in Indiana, might not have even come into the popular mindset if not for Native economy of moving corn throughout the Americas.
Well, if you want to think about Native impacts on world history, mm-hmm. That would be one piece of a huge story, right? I mean, all around the world, corn is a staple
Absolutely.
Crop, and it's from here.
Oh, yes. So we are talking a little bit, and I am Lewis Malone. I'm here speaking with three professors from IU about Native North American cultures here. And we are talking a little bit right now about the Natives, the Native people that were here prior to the European colonists. So we have talked a little bit about them. We know they're very diverse. And we want to move on to this idea, this holiday we're going to have in 2 days, Thanksgiving. It originated in 1621. Is that right, Dr. Snyder?
Well, you know, one thing that Jason, I know, wanted to mention is that the idea of Thanksgiving is really a harvest festival, which goes back to ancient times in North America and also in Europe, actually. One thing that these people have in common when they come together is that they're both agricultural societies who are used to getting together and having feasts with their allies and friends during the good times of harvest, right?
Yes.
So the one holiday that we're remembering specifically 2 days from now does happen in 1621. That's the kind of mythic origin story that we think of that has to do with the Plymouth colony and the Wampanoags getting together with the Plymouth colonists and celebrating the first harvest at Plymouth. And it's kind of a funny story, actually, because the Plymouth colonists are harvesting their first crop, which includes corn, which Squanto taught them how to do, by the way. They didn't know how to do it before then. They didn't initially invite the Wampanoags, so they started going out and, like, hunting for animals to have at the feast, and the Wampanoags heard their guns go off, and they're afraid, actually, the Wampanoags are afraid that that Plymouth is being attacked, and they're allies of Plymouth, so they go to see, you know, is anything the matter? Is everything mm-hmm. okay? And so that's the point at which the Plymouth colonists invite them to have a meal together, and so the two groups bring these foods together in this this way that celebrates their alliance and their relationship.
Mm-hmm. And that sounds, and so interesting, because if we think of other times when the Europeans had attempted to settle in the North America, it had not been successful. And there were multiple settlements in the United States that were not successful, sometimes due to adverse climate or adverse effects, things that, you know, bad luck, you could even toss in. But the Plymouth colony would not have been successful without the cooperation with the Native people. And so at this time of year, we get together and we have our harvest festival, and we think back to the Pilgrims and the Native Americans coming together and beginning that the beginning of a European settlement in Plymouth, Massachusetts. So if we're talking about that, but this is not something that would be completely foreign to the native people. They would generally have a, it's a very cultural, significant part of their, of what they believe, it's the idea of giving thanks.
Yeah, this is Jason again. Jason. There's a couple themes that are already sort of in our discussion that are getting braided together, right? One has to do with this European-American holiday, which Christina has narrated the kind of foundational moment for that story. But the only thing that I would want to add to that conversation is that on the one hand, that European-American custom does have, you know, European roots, and they have to do with religious conflict in Europe. They have to do with reactions against the sort of holiday traditions of Catholicism. Mm-hmm. And so we can do a kind of ancient history of the idea that came with those colonists. Yes. At the same time, the American holiday that we know is really unstable. It's really a recent phenomenon in the scheme of things, and it was only after the American Revolution that there started to be something like a national holiday.
Yes. 1789, yeah, was there, that George Washington?
Yeah, there was an older scenario in which local leaders would proclaim fasting days as well as feast days for a whole host of reasons. So from a European colonist point of view, it's not primordial, you know, that there'd be this Thursday in November, right? And that's a relatively new thing. Now, the other side of that coin is the one that you just evoked, which has to do with the idea, which for purpose of conversation, we might flip around and call giving thanks, as opposed to the holiday of Thanksgiving. And here, the continuity is really, really clear in the context of Native traditions. Now, the three of us all have specific experiences in particular parts of Indian country that we're drawing upon. And I think all of us would hesitate to make categorical proclamations. That said, the idea of giving thanks is a hugely important theme in every Native community that I know. And it takes many forms. But one point of continuity with Thanksgiving is, we know it as an American holiday, is that there are calendar customs, that is, times of year in which special emphasis is placed on acts of Thanksgiving. And oftentimes they do have to do with the agricultural round, when do various kinds of crops get harvested. So that in Eastern North America, which is sort of our frame of reference, there are events like green corn ceremonies, which are not final harvest ceremonies, but first harvest ceremonies.
Okay.
And those are a super important instances in which communities and families and individuals convey thanks for the things that are important in their lives, including, obviously, the food that sustains Native communities and non-Native communities. One point about Thanksgiving in Native communities is that it's often tied to an to another set of activities which relate to, in essence, asking, right? So that many Native communities, part of the year is spent, in essence, doing the right things that are expected of people and conveying a kind of petition to creation or to the Creator, seeking things like health for one's family and food for one's community. And then when those things which are needed in life and that are important to people's lives are bestowed, then the flip side of that comes around, and then it's time to give thanks, right? So we can think about the annual round being a kind of alternation between anticipating things and seeking, you know, blessings, and then expressing thanks for those blessings in turn, right?
Yeah,
if you think
absolutely.
About that seasonally, there are ceremonies in many communities that happen in winter, which are anticipatory for planting, and then thinking about the end of a planting season, giving thanks for the bounty that's been provided. Those kinds of themes, not universal, but widespread in Indian country.
Okay. So it's just a repeated sort of giving thanks. Thanks for throughout the year. You have the green harvest, you have the thank you for, you know, the anticipation of what will be coming. This is something that is really deep in the roots of the cultures that you study.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you are specifically in the Eastern United States? Is that
Yes, I've been fortunate to spend time with Native communities from the East, particularly in Oklahoma, where many Native peoples from Eastern North America were forced to be relocated in a process which looks a lot like ethnic cleansing from their homelands in the East to what's now Oklahoma.
Well, and that is something that we do always need to remember, that while we sit here and we think about Thanksgiving and the time when the Wampanoag and the settlers were able to work together and shortly thereafter, the Wampanoag were really put in a bad position based on with more English settlers coming. You know, it wasn't long before Boston was founded to the north, and I believe it's the north, and so it puts you in a really awkward position for the Wampanoag, and that's something that is really consistent throughout the history of the United States. Does anybody else want to comment for a moment just about giving thanks? I know you, Dr. Snyder, study in the southeast of the mm-hmm. southeast. Are the things that Dr. Jason Jackson were just speaking about, are those consistent in the South?
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And actually, the people that Jason has worked most closely with, the Utes, are native to the southeast.
Okay.
So this green corn ceremony that he mentioned in particular is really widespread across Eastern North America. And even today, even though many Native people have moved away from a primarily agricultural economy, green corn is still a time when people get together and have ceremonies and celebrate the renewal of the earth. And I think another telling fact, actually, is that in a lot of Native cultures, the names of the months are after whatever is harvested in that month. So whatever comes ripe, there's the strawberry month, and that's very telling as well.
Absolutely. And so we are going to be coming up on a break here shortly. We're discussing Thanksgiving, the idea of giving thanks, and Native North American cultures, or Native American cultures, I should say, with three professors from Indiana University. We have Dr. Brian Gilley. We also have Dr. Jason Jackson, and we have Dr. Christina Snyder. The break music tonight is actually going to be some samples from some Native music that was provided to us by Dr. Jackson. This first music we're going to be using is called the Stomp Dance. Did you want to comment on that a little bit before we went into it?
Well, the singer that we'll hear is a man that I knew, a leader from the Shawnee people. His name was James Squirrel. He passed away a few years ago, but he was a great singer, famous all over Indian country as a singer. And the 2 points I would make, one is that as a Shawnee person, while he lived in Oklahoma, his ancestors lived here in Indiana. And so there's a local tie-in, and it's a reminder that those of us who live in Indiana today live on lands that are part of Indian country still, and that are homelands for Native peoples who maybe aren't always here in the state of Indiana. The other thing that I would say about the song that he'll be singing is that it's a kind of social dance song that's performed today in the context of the kinds of ceremonies of Thanksgiving that we've been talking about. The green corn ceremony is one example of that, but another one is a thing that the Shawnee have, which is called the bread dance. And the bread dance happens twice a year, but it's very, very much a kind of Thanksgiving rite as well. In the spring, it happens in the context of planting, and in the fall, it happens this time of year in the context of the end of the harvest and the beginning of the winter season. So the song that we'll be singing is a social dance song, but it's the kind of music that you hear at the sorts of ceremonial gatherings that we were just talking about.
All right. Well, I look forward to hearing it. You're listening to Interchange on WFHB. We will be right back.
Hey!
Welcome back. You're listening to Interchange on WFHB. My name is Lewis Malone. I'm your host for this evening. And I'm here with three professors from Indiana University in the school, of various schools. But we have Dr. Brian Gilley, who is the director of First Nations and Educational and Cultural Center and is an associate professor of anthropology at Indiana University. I have Dr. Jason Jackson, associate professor of folklore and American studies at Indiana University. And I have Dr. Christina Snyder, assistant professor of history and American studies at Indiana University. Before we get back into our discussion about Thanksgiving and just Native American history in the United States, I wanted to give Dr. Gilley an opportunity. The First Nations Educational and Cultural Center, I have been in Bloomington a long time. I've never heard of it. Can you explain what you do there?
It began really, I think, in 2002-ish. And it's had various iterations over the last decade. And I was brought in 2010 as director. And what we've began doing with the center is really making it a student-oriented cultural resource for students on campus who are Native American. We also partake in recruiting, the support of Native American faculty, and staff, and we also have an educational mission to educate the campus on Native American issues and culture. And over the last 2 years that I've been working, I've seen an increase in participation, but also a significant increase in us, people associated with the center, getting invited to do things like this. People getting invited to participate in cultural activities on campus around diversity. So we're doing the work. We're trying to accomplish a lot of things on campus, and I think we're getting a lot done. And so I really appreciate that opportunity that the university's given me to do that.
It sounds fantastic, Jason Jackson. Explain a little bit of what you're doing. You're at the School of Folklore and Ethnomusicology.
Yes, I teach in the folklore program.
The
Department of Folklore and Ethnomusicology.
Okay.
When I'm not in Bloomington, I'm doing the usual professor thing. One of the places I spend a lot of time is Oklahoma, where my work among Native communities happens. In that context, one of the things that I've tried to focus on are collaborative projects with Native communities, working on cultural and historical preservation projects, museum exhibitions, and those sorts of things. And then here at Indiana, while most of the students that I work with aren't involved in Native studies, some are, but the kinds of work that I do tends to be focused in places like museums and focused on community collaborations.
Okay, excellent. And Dr. Snyder, you actually just came back from being on leave.
I did.
Just a little bit about your work here at the university.
Sure. I'm in history and American studies, and I'm a historian by training. I do some interdisciplinary work, but I focus mostly on Native peoples of the South. And my current research is about the first National Indian Boarding School, which was actually in Kentucky, pretty close to us. And it started off as a collaborative project between the Choctaws and the federal government. But eventually there were 16 different tribes from all across the Southeast and Midwest, including Potawatomis and Miamis from here in Indiana.
Mm-hmm. Well, that sounds fantastic. I want to talk a little bit here in the second segment about what we are, the kind of where the United States of America has been, how the Native Americans have influenced us, what their role has been for a lot of the time. It's not always a happy tale, but I think it's one that needs to be told. And I part of that includes, you know, the work that Dr. Snyder, you've done in specifically with the Native Americans in the South and their relation and how they interacted with African Americans. Mm-hmm. And that's something I didn't know if you wanted to speak to a little bit.
Sure. My first book was called Slavery in Indian Country. Mm-hmm. And what it explores are captivity and slavery among Native Americans in the South from pre-Columbian times all the way through 1842, which is kind of the end of the removal era that Jason alluded to, when most Native people in the region were forcibly removed to Indian territory. And so basically what I was looking at are people who are taken captive, usually in warfare, but sometimes people are traded, who come into Indian country. And I was looking at the ways in which they relate to the broader community, the ways in which those people are integrated or not integrated into the community, and what that reveals about Native identity over time. So the story that I was telling was a really diverse one that included Native people from a lot of different nations, but also people of African descent and European descent. Another issue also is that, you know, as Brian mentioned, this is a complicated history when we're talking about Native peoples. They have interacted in complicated ways with their white and black neighbors and have their own ideas about race and nationhood and citizenship and mm-hmm. what that all means.
And I think that that moment you're talking about with the removal, the forcible removal mm-hmm. of Native Americans from the South mm-hmm. and the East to Indian territory, we might know as Oklahoma mm-hmm. these days, correct me on the Trail of Tears. I think that's something that I learned about as a young boy. That's what we're talking about, when Andrew Jackson coming in and removing people.
That's right. So the name that most people know it by actually comes from Cherokee, what the Cherokees called mm-hmm. it, the trail where they cried. Other Native groups had different names for it. The Potawatomis called it the Trail of Death. Mm-hmm. But you get a kind of sense for, you know, what this experience was like. There are very high mortality rates. The provisioning for this removal was contracted out to agents who were often corrupt and didn't do a very good job of taking care of people. And what people often learn in school, I think, mostly does deal with Cherokee removal. And what we need to realize is that removal was actually a blanket policy that covered Native tribes throughout the East, all Native tribes east of the Mississippi, supposedly. Mm-hmm. 100,000 Indians were forced to remove to Indian territory. So it's not something that just happened to Cherokees. It's something that affected Native peoples here in Indiana and across the East.
Mm-hmm.
I would just add that while the present-day state of Oklahoma, where much of our interest as a group lies, is a big part of that story. That mm-hmm. that's the place that was Oklahoma and Indian Territory. And the other piece of that story, though, is that there were other destinations that peoples from the East were forced to relocate to. Sometimes, for instance, if we think about the Wyandot and other groups who were sent to Kansas, what's okay. now Kansas,
yes.
they experienced removal on more than one occasion, right? So that there were groups who were forced through a series of dislocating relocations from the eastern seaboard maybe to Ohio and then to Kansas and then forced again from Kansas to what's now Oklahoma. So that the time period we're talking about here is a broader one than the case of Cherokee removal. And even Cherokee removal is more complicated than we learned in grade school. And that Oklahoma wasn't always the only destination, even if eventually it became a key destination for groups who thought they were going to spend the rest of their history in Kansas or wherever.
Yeah.
So that, as with everything, it always gets more complicated the more you look into it.
Oh, absolutely. And I think it is something for us to think about as we think about, as we just spoke about in the last segment, the idea of the modern Thanksgiving that we have and the ideas and the pictures that people draw and the ideas.
Yeah.
And then you think that these people that assisted us or assisted those first settlers in having success were then repeatedly removed. And we even mentioned that the Wampanoag of shortly thereafter were if I read correctly, would not be shortly thereafter they would not even be allowed to use their own language. They would be, you know, so, and so this is kind of the history of our nation and the native people that we have here. But it doesn't mean that all those cultures have died. They're still here. They're still vibrant, and they're still people are still acting and working to protect them mm-hmm. as much as possible. So if we're talking about the various tribes that were, you know, distinctly, and they might have been removed, how did that work? How did that function when you have a lot of different tribes from a lot of different areas, and they're all moved perhaps to a location where they don't really know how to survive, or they don't really have a lot of comfort or are familiar with each other, in at least in close proximity? Dr. Snyder.
Well, one thing that's interesting to note is that these Eastern people are coming into contact with Plains tribes, some of them for the first time. I mean, some people had hunted in what's now Indian Territory previously, but some of them had no experience with Comanches or Kiowas, for example. And those people perceive Eastern Indians as invaders. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of conflict early on between these newcomers and the people who are already there. But one thing that happens is that there are a lot of intertribal councils when all these different Native peoples are first removed to Indian Territory. So I was actually just writing about this earlier today. There was a council at Tahlequah in 1843 where there were over 4,000 Indians in attendance representing 22 different nations from across that region. And it's very telling that each speech, so whenever a certain tribal leader gave a speech, that speech had to be translated 9 times so that people would be able to understand. And even then, probably everyone in attendance may not have understood. Mm-hmm. So anyway, people are, I think, you know, Native people are constantly adapting and surviving. And I think that when all these different folks are getting together in Indian Territory, they're trying to reimagine indigenous nationhood and new ways to live together and build bridges while understanding that there's conflict there as well.
Yeah, they're also, I mean, one of the critical things is what happened with the Wampanoag and the Pilgrims is this extension of kinship or extension of Native meanings to that interaction. And I think when you talk about Indian Territory, these folks were also extending kin relationships to one another, and they were intermarrying, but they were also exchanging ceremonies. They were also exchanging belief systems. They were politically allying with one another, and they were also, they were also developing these really long-term relationships that you see, 100, 200 years later, that still exist.
Mm. Yes, Dr. Jackson.
I just want to pick up there. I mean, this is an important theme, and it can be tied back to Thanksgiving. One of the things we're talking about are the kind of simple stories, maybe not always accurate stories, that most of us learn in our kind of American
Absolutely.
Grade school
Yes.
education. And we can come back to paper bag clothing and Thanksgiving and whatnot. but if we pick up where Christine and Brian have been going, one of the stories there, I mean, it ties back into the giving thanks business, is mm-hmm. that there are very sophisticated systems of diplomacy
Yes.
Present in Native communities. Now, oftentimes when we learn about, if we learn anything about sort of the basics of Native history vis-a-vis diplomacy, it of course defaults to Native, non-Native, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we talk about treaties, but with the Spanish or with the British or with the United States. But the point that Brian was adding to the conversation a moment ago has to do with the fact that Native peoples sought to engage and continue at one level to try to engage with non-Native peoples in terms which are that pre-exist European colonization.
Okay.
And so that when we hear about nation-to-nation relations as the kind of cornerstone of Native sovereignty, that's an idea that goes all the way back to pre-Columbian times. And the kinds of councils that Christina was evoking a moment ago those are gatherings which are often happening with no native, with no non-native presence, and without a kind of European or a European American motivation for the gathering. Now, sometimes there are those kinds of intertribal councils that do include non-native actors, but the idea of international diplomacy happened before Europeans got here, and it still happens today. And one key mechanism in which that gets worked out are the kinds of ceremonies and gatherings of giving thanks that we were talking about earlier, right? Yes. Those are prime locations for different Native communities to come together and work out not only spiritual goals like giving thanks, but also social ends like working out livable, hospitable relations with one another. And a key dynamic there is the idea of hospitality. And the idea of hospitality is really important all over Indian country. And we think about the image we have of that first Thanksgiving, that kind of mythic, somewhat unreal first Thanksgiving. Well, the key image that's present in that from a Native point of view is the idea of hospitable treatment of strangers, and the idea that food is a really important agent of hospitality, the idea that sharing of food is a really important idea. Well, here we are back to a kind of key link between American Thanksgiving and the giving thanks idea that we've been talking about.
Absolutely. And so that what we spoke about at the beginning, where there was an economy, there were interactions amongst the various people speaking different languages. There was a world. So there was a culture. There was, you know, a pre-existing. I know that I think a lot of people think that when the Europeans landed, they brought all these things. But these things were here, and they just kept getting shoved to the side, into you know, and it's why we in part why we have Thanksgiving, and it's in part you know. And it's in part what we keep seeing when we talk about all of these things, where we talk about what Thanksgiving is and what was going on in the Indian territory so long ago. And even today, I'm sure they still have they have councils and things like that. But we haven't gotten that far in our discussion yet. We're just in the 19th century. But we will be taking a break here just in a second. We do have a second selection that was provided to us by Dr. Jackson. This is a shuffle dance.
Yeah, one of the peoples most famous for their devotion to the idea of giving thanks are the various nations that European Americans know as the Iroquois or the Haudenosaunee. And the song that we'll hear is a kind of music called the New Women's Shuffle Dance. These are recent compositions of a kind of dance song. They're sung increasingly by women as well as male singers. And this is a women's group from the Six Nations Reserve in Canada. This is a kind of song that, again, is a social dance, but it's a kind of social dance that's done in connection with, sometimes done in connection with the kinds of gatherings focused on Thanksgiving that we've been talking about. And we can talk maybe after the break about some of the ideas present in those gatherings. But this is a beautiful song by the Six Nations women singers, and it's a shuffle dance.
All right. You're listening to Interchange here on WFHB. We'll be right back.
Support for WFHB comes from Bloomington Realty, with offices at 713 South Walnut Street in Bloomington. Bloomington Realty is a community realtor serving Bloomington and surrounding counties for over 15 years. Available today for all your real estate needs. More information is available by calling 323-2323. We'll be back to Interchange in a moment.
Ah!
You're listening to Interchange on WFHB. My name is Lewis Malone. I'm your host today, and I'm here with three professors from Indiana University. We have Dr. Christina Snyder, Assistant Professor of History and American Studies at Indiana University. Dr. Jason Jackson, Associate Professor of Folklore and American Studies at Indiana University. And Dr. Brian Gilley, who is the director of the First Nations Educational and Cultural Center and is an associate professor of anthropology at Indiana University. So we've been talking a lot. We've been talking about the history of Thanksgiving. We've been talking about Native peoples in North America and South America and what it was like before European settlers came. But it is 2 days before Thanksgiving. I think the holiday that was, I believe, set in place on this day by FDR, to help spur Christmas shopping. And so we have, and there's a time where there's a lot of images that are about, and it's a time to examine, I guess, the public consciousness, the people, public conceptions of Native Americans. And I didn't know if you wanted to speak to that a bit, Dr. Gilley.
Well, I think one of the, going into any grocery store or department store, you see the image of the pilgrim and the native person in buckskin with the feather, and they're exchanging something, or the pilgrim's giving the Indian a good pat on the back, you know. And I think that that's the image that often evokes an enormous amount of anger among native people, because they really consider pilgrims and any settlers as living on stolen land. And Thanksgiving can, to certain people, represent a celebration of stealing that land. And so I think it makes it controversial in some ways, but the ways in the imagery that you see doesn't really help ease that upsettedness on the part of Native people.
Especially with the close proximity to Columbus Day, which we know has a lot of negative, there's a lot of negative feelings about Columbus Day, and then Thanksgiving shortly thereafter. I didn't know, when we talk about where we are now, you know, it's 2012, and we still have things, we still have Chief Wahoo and the Cleveland Indians, and we still have the Washington Redskins, we still have numerous sports teams. Where are, And we know that Native Americans, demographically, in terms of where they are in terms of poverty and things like that, there are some real struggles there. And they have this vibrant, beautiful history. Where are we in terms of, you know, I guess I'm looking for a little commentary, perhaps, Dr. Jackson, on culturally, you know, where we are as Americans, and then where the Native people, how they view us, and even though giving of thanks is so important, and I think I'm sure you mentioned plenty of Native people do celebrate Thanksgiving in many different ways. Where are we now? I guess is kind of a good the ultimate question I'm trying to say.
Well. I'm just one voice in the conversation,
yes.
But if you think about Columbus Day vis-a-vis Thanksgiving, which are the sort of two examples you flagged as understandably provocative from the point of view of Native people in the United States and in the Americas, the contrast, I think, is useful in that it's very hard for Native peoples to see any good sense in Columbus Day, right? It just doesn't, there's no redeeming resonance in that context, in the sense that that's an unambiguously colonial holiday, right? It's about celebrating a conquest. On the other hand, Thanksgiving, as we were trying to suggest before, pulls in two directions at once. The sort of story that often gets told in a kind of American context really does have this sort of colonial resonance that we're just talking about. On the other hand, it's called Thanksgiving, right? And when push comes to shove, many Native people say, well, you know, we don't like the packaging, and the imagery is really troubling, and it's so simplified, and it's really painful for Native kids to be asked to make paper bag vests and headdresses alongside their non-Native classmates. I mean, there's a lot of unhealthy stuff that's gotten packed into Thanksgiving, and that relates to broader themes in American life. On the other hand, it's called Thanksgiving, right? And at its core, how does it get celebrated? The core way in which I think all Americans who celebrate Thanksgiving do it is usually as a family gathering, and family is so important in Native communities, as in not so many non-Native communities. Yes. It gets celebrated with celebratory food ways, right? There's special foods, right? And those foods are old-fashioned foods, right? They're ancestral foods. They're not the way that we eat on an everyday basis. Mm-hmm. And the idea of eating old-fashioned foods in a celebratory way, I mean, Native people really like that idea, right?
It's easy to get behind that.
It's really easy to get behind that. And the idea of giving thanks, that was our theme earlier, right, is so important. And so Thanksgiving is tricky in a way that Columbus Day isn't. And so if you spend time in Indian country, there's countless ways that Thanksgiving gets celebrated. But if you were to, there are going to be commonalities like family and food and Thanksgiving, and then there's going to be discontinuities, right? You're not going to see a lot of Native people getting together and enacting stereotypical representations of Native peoples, right?
Yes, absolutely.
And I think the message that Native activists would have for us on the subject of Thanksgiving would be, can't that stuff get stripped out of this thing? Isn't it a good and beautiful idea of giving thanks and celebrating with family? Do we really need to perpetuate stereotypes of Native people, right? Yes. Why does that part have to tag along with a holiday which we know is made up, right? It's not primordial. It's not ancient. Right. So why does it need, you know, construction paper headdresses?
Yes. Well, and it's a good question, I think, in the grand scheme of things. Why do we hold on to these things that seem to be so hurtful to people moving forward? Dr. Gilley.
Well, I always say, because when I have students, I taught at the University of North Dakota, where the Native student population hovers around 10%. So these kinds of issues, and they had a mascot. So these issues were really raw. And the thing that I always told them was that mascots, Thanksgiving, Columbus Day, all of these celebrations mask unequal power relationships.
Okay.
And what I mean by that is that it's easier to digest colonialism, the post-colonial condition, and social problems that Natives experience if you can create it into a caricature, and a caricature is your reference point. Then all that other stuff kind of falls to the wayside. And the thing that I heard non-Natives say over and over again about mascots was, well, we're honoring this chief. Yes. And the students were like, well, it's not really an honor. And that's the thing that's the phrase that masks unequal power relationships. That became my answer to everything, because I didn't know what else to say, because it was so ubiquitous, and students were so frustrated by it, you know, at their own university, you know, doing this.
And so we at Indiana University, of course, the name of the state says something in itself, but Indiana University may not have those things with a mascot, but it's clear as day if you look across the nation what we see. Apart from that, other cultural influences Native Americans have had, I think of the in the United States, in the culture of the American culture. Yeah, Dr. Jackson.
It's a tricky conversation, and we have to be mindful of the fact that on the one hand, there's some rhetorical power that comes from engaging in the kind of let's list some important contributions frame of reference, right? I even did it earlier, right? I said corn, right? Think about corn syrups and Coke, and we eat cornflakes. Corn's like one of the most important things in the world now. Mm-hmm. Native peoples gave us that, in quotes, right? But there's a downside to that, right? Which is that it produces a kind of laundry list of great achievements. Oftentimes they're like food.
Yes.
And, you know, and I've been pro food in this conversation, but
athletes.
Right. But yeah. The point that I think is fundamental to Brian's observation a moment ago is that this sort of enrichment through a kind of list of contributions has a downside, right?
I mean, yes.
What Native people, I think, from what I can tell as an interlocutor with people in Indian country, would much prefer, rather than a list of contributions, is a generalized relationship of respect
mm-hmm.
combined with political voice, so that when Native people speak up on issues that are important to Native people, that they're acknowledged and heard in a meaningful political way, so that mm-hmm. it gets us somewhere to acknowledge that Native peoples are active participants in American life. It gets us somewhere to say Native peoples made important contributions to the unfolding of the history on this continent, mm-hmm. But that's not as useful as political voice.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I would never want to overshadow that message. What I was thinking of is that as we move forward in this country and we try to progress, there are lots of things that I think the Native people that have been experienced, you know, that the Native people have embraced or has been a part of their culture that could really be embraced moving forward by the probably what I might call the dominant culture, if you don't mind me saying it that way. And I didn't know if there were some ideas in that regard. So because some of the things that I was thinking of as I was hoping to speak to you about, Dr. Gilley, about the Two-Spirit people that you might be studying.
Well, that's a whole nother show.
Another show? Okay, that's fine.
But, I think the thing that Two-Spirit people represent as a contemporary social movement, Two-Spirit, by the way, is GLBTQ, gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender natives who have taken a historic incorporation of gender diversity and sexual diversity made a contemporary nod to that past, which colonialism helped bring about an end to those Native traditions on a large scale. There's still some communities that have it, but it's very, very rare. And so I think as a contemporary social movement, Two-Spirit people represent that kind of merge of historic cultural conservative traditional practice and a need to exist in a contemporary world, that need to bridge between their communities and gay society in America. And that's the argument that I always make about those folks, is that that's at the fundamental core of what I think a lot of Native people want, is that they want a sense of autonomy over their identity and their cultural practice, but also to be Americans and live in America and have American culture.
Mm-hmm. We're coming to the end of the show, but Dr. Jackson.
Now, you're now looking for a kind of broader sort of contribution.
Yeah.
And Brian's just reflected on a key lesson from his work. And to tie into the conversation, we might think, for instance, about environmental mm-hmm. issues. Maybe that's sort of the thing you were looking at. I alluded to this before the break, fundamental to, in Eastern North America in particular, fundamental to many of these Thanksgiving events is acknowledging, thanking all of creation. Mm-hmm. And it's beautiful how this is done. There are oftentimes speeches. The Shawnee practice this, the Iroquois peoples practice this. There are speeches that begin with the lowliest thing on the earth and work systematically all the way to the heavens, right? And thanks is given, appreciation is expressed for everything in creation. And that's an idea which is fundamental to these sorts of issues we've been talking about. If Native peoples would want all of American society to think about a range of issues, certainly the environment would be one of them.
Well, and I thank you for that. I thank all the guests tonight. We are coming to the end of the show. I want to thank Dr. Christina Snyder, Assistant Professor of History and American Studies at Indiana University, Dr. Jason Jackson, Associate Professor of Folklore and American Studies at Indiana University, and Dr. Brian Gilley, the Director of the First Nations Educational and Cultural Center and an Associate Professor of Anthropology at Indiana University. Thank you all for being with me today.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lewis.
The executive producer of Interchange and tonight's engineer is Allison Bektesh. Original theme music is by Jamil Effiam. Please stay tuned for the Jazz Menagerie with Brother William, coming up next on WFHB.
Real people.
Real issues.
This is your forum.
This is Interchange.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers working in the studios of Community Radio WFHB in Bloomington, Indiana.
Interchange fosters unfiltered open dialogue on the people, issues, and events impacting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Comments, suggestions, and program ideas may be sent directly to the Interchange staff.
The email address is news@wfhb.org.
That address once again is news@wfhb.org.